Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I'm sorry to report that the war for the free world is a more challenging fight at the moment than it was just last week, in the sense that we have lost one of our great heroes in that war, an unsung hero, mostly, but a hero nonetheless. His name was Philip Haney. Philip was a remarkable man, a man I think by most measures one would call a Renaissance man. He was an entomologist by training, a bug guy, I like to call him, who brought to the work that he wound up doing a passion, a competency, a degree of rigor that proved to make him not only a very formidable man in the categorization and monitoring and analysis of insects, but also when those same skills were brought to bear against jihadists, one of our country's foremost experts on the problem that Sharia supremacism represents, not just overseas, and he did spend a lot of time overseas becoming exposed to and familiar with it, but also here at home. In fact, in the course of his travels as an entomologist overseas for the United States government, he became so interested in and committed to understanding the environment in the Middle East in which he was working that he taught himself Arabic, and he began to study deeply the Quran, the Hadiths, the other sacred texts of Islam, its jurisprudence, its practice, its doctrines, and the kinds of behavior that the authorities of Islam believe what they call Sharia commands all Muslims to engage in. With all of those skills, the ability to classify, the ability to follow, as he would put it, the subjects of his analysis to the nest, and as a result of his mastery of so much of the sort of DNA, if you will, of Islam, Phil Haney became, as a founding member of the Department of Homeland Security, transferred from entomology to protecting our homeland, one of the country's foremost experts on the subject and most capable practitioners of the business of protecting us from enemies, foreign and domestic. And of course, doing that is part and parcel of the oath that he took, to which he remained committed throughout his life. 15 years of which was spent in Customs and Border Patrol in the Department of Homeland Security, most of it at the Hartsfield Airport in Atlanta, one of the major points of entry and exit for this country, a vantage point from which he was able to monitor with care the various comings and goings of people who he would discern on the basis of his careful and exhaustive research were in fact tied to various Sharia supremacist groups who were, by virtue of their commitment to Sharia's jihad, prepared to pursue it either violently or stealthily. And Phil Haney brought to the attention of his superiors for some 15 years that reality. He did it when people were more or less open to the information, and he did it when they weren't, particularly in the latter case during the Obama administration. Phil chronicled his experiences trying to tell the truth about those who believe it is their divinely ordained mission to impose Sharia worldwide, to enforce the diktat of Islam on Muslims and non-Muslims alike in this country as well as overseas. In the course of his book, See Something, Say Nothing, he documented the 9 different investigations he was subjected to during the Obama years, including a criminal one. He was fortunately, despite incredible hardship and stress and heartache for both himself and his family, finally exonerated in every single one of those. And in due course, he retired with full benefits. He went on after his service in government to continue to serve, including writing his book and speaking out publicly on this program, among other places. And we're going to hear 2 particularly, I think, relevant clips from previous interviews that Phil Haney did with us in the latter part of this program. But I just simply want to say that we're dealing with a man whose capabilities were tremendously important during his time in service to our government and afterwards, and are desperately needed now. We're going to hear next from a man who knew Philip Haney extremely well, who worked closely with him, who helped him through some of the very difficult experiences that he had during the Obama years, a man who was himself subjected to quite a bit of job action and other difficulties from superiors, in this case in the FBI, who did not want to hear the truth about the enemy within, let alone take steps needed to bring it to heel. His name is John Guandolo, a former special agent in the Federal Bureau of Investigation. But before I conclude this brief introduction to this important, well, memorial program to Philip Haney, I just want to say how much his friendship, his role as a mentor, really, as well as a colleague, meant to me personally. I have never really known anyone who better fit the definition of a gentle man. His humble and self-effacing demeanor sometimes was mistaken for a lack of firmness, resolve, and capability. Nothing could have been farther from the truth. My life was enriched by the privilege of knowing and working with Phil. I will miss him desperately, as will so many of us, especially the millions and millions of Americans who will never know his name, let alone the important contribution he made to our national security, a contribution that was cut short when he died by a gunshot wound in California last week. We mourn him, we laud him, and we will miss him. And we'll hear more about why from John Guandolo right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are mourning the passing of a great American, Philip Haney, and I'm very pleased to be able to do it with a man who knew him well, who worked with him closely, and who is perhaps better equipped to assess the importance of Phil Haney, his life and his work, than anybody else. His name is John Guandolo. He's no stranger to this program and our audience. He is a man who has served his country with great distinction, going back to his time as a midshipman at the Naval Academy, as a Marine Force Recon officer, as a SWAT team leader in the FBI, as a special agent specializing specifically in counterterrorism in the Federal Bureau of Investigation, And now, as the leader of an incredibly important organization, understanding the threat. He is himself, as I said about Phil a moment ago, a Renaissance man, a musician, a wonderful trainer and educator, notably about the jihad here in America and elsewhere. An incredible resource. He's the author of several books, including Raising a Jihadi Generation. You can follow him at understandingthethreat.com. I'm so pleased to have him with us to help me reflect on the life and times and contributions of Phil Haney. John Guandolo, welcome back.
Thanks, Frank. Thank you so much for having me, especially for something like this. I'm really appreciative to be a part of this.
Well, I'm grateful to you too, my friend. I first met Phil Haney on the margins of a training session that you had done, I think, back in 2012, if I'm not mistaken, John. Just give us a little background on how you came to know him and the nature of your, you know, colleagueship.
Well, I came to know Phil, and I was really blessed to know him because we used to joke we were brothers from another mother. He was in the DHS, I was in the FBI, and both had discovered this massive jihadi network inside the United States that had deeply penetrated our government and our decision-making process, and both of us had taught others about it and conducted investigations into it. And so when I'd first heard of him through somebody in the Department of Defense and then met Phil in person, and as we started talking, it was our stories. There were pieces of our stories that were direct mirrors of one another. And the hardships that we had faced inside the government and the responses we had to what both of us thought were earnest, investigative, factual information that we laid on the table for the leadership, in my case of the FBI, in his case for DHS. And in both cases, what we found to our surprise was resistance instead of support. And instead of our headquarters, our respective headquarters, putting support and money and more people and resources behind what we were doing, both of us were attacked and we were internally investigated and we were shut down to the point in Phil's case, which I think is practically much more significant than what happened in my case, is he had literally put over 800 records inside DHS's secure system of names of individuals and organizations that were hostile. And those were removed under the Obama administration by DHS officials under the order of the Obama administration, at least to the information that we have, which is incredible because these are 800 records of hostile people and groups. And to me, his contribution is unmatched in anybody in our circles just because of that. And he, not only that, he had the biggest investigations on the terrorist threat more than anyone else in DHS. And he was explaining things to the leadership that nobody else was explaining and putting things together and putting intelligence and investigative pieces together that really painted a portrait of the threat as we know it that nobody else was doing at that level.
And John, one of the things that I was struck by about Phil, and I mentioned earlier to our audience that you'd never know it from his humility and his self-effacing nature, but he had actually a command, not only of the unbelievably enormous body of literature, sacred and otherwise, and doctrines and jurisprudence and so on of Islam, but he actually knew it from the point of view of somebody who had mastered, as I recall, not just modern Arabic, but rather ancient Arabic. So he could really study these documents in their original language. I mean, this was a degree of proficiency about the nature of the problem, the wellsprings of the problem with what I call Sharia supremacism, that I think is extraordinarily rare, if not completely unmatched, certainly on our side in this struggle against the imposition of Sharia upon us. You've done a lot of deep diving on all of this as well, but I think you would be the first to acknowledge this was in a class by itself, was it not?
Yeah, I said in a very brief eulogy, if you will, that I wrote over the weekend to Phil that the gap that Phil Haney leaves it's unfillable, and it really is. I think you're on the right track, Frank. Phil was such a unique individual, not only just in life, but in this as a warrior. And he really was. You use the phrase a Renaissance man. I would not use that about myself, but I would use that about Phil, because not only was he the guy was an entomologist. He was a geek scientist. He used to call himself a nerd, and yet it was a little self-effacing intentionally with tongue in cheek, because he was a really cool guy too. And if at first blush, you'd be like, yeah, he's a nerdy scientist. But when you actually got to know the guy, he was incredibly strong, grounded, anchored human being who had a deep, deep faith, a very critical, a mind that was built for critical thought, and he had trained it for critical thought. And because of his experiences in places like Yemen and other places like that, doing his work as a scientist, he became very interested in the culture, in Islam, in the history, and he did his own study. And then after 9/11, being drawn, like patriots are, into doing something, into service, he joined the DHS and became a plank holder, an original member of DHS, and arguably not one of their best, their greatest investigator, who put together the biggest cases that many of them were recognized and he was awarded for them, and yet they tried to drive him out.
And that's what I want to get at. Yeah, John, we're going to run out of time before we run out of wonderful things to talk about with respect to Phil Haney, but I want specifically, as somebody who, as you said, experienced the kind of retribution that Phil Haney did, maybe not quite on its severest scale, but talk about what Phil was subjected to. And I'm particularly interested in the role played by the lawyers from Hillary Clinton's State Department, who insisted that he had to shut down and destroy the database that he had created about this organization, Tablighi Jamaat. I don't think probably most of us have ever heard of that group. Tell us a little bit about it and how this really was, the sort of consummate example of the Obama administration's alignment with the enemy with respect to Sharia supremacism and the kind of retribution that, as I say, people like you and he faced.
Well, okay, so that's a big ask. So let me first start with the attacks on him. Listen, he put over 800 records into DHS's database, and in the Obama administration, for instance, you had Ingrid Mattson, the president of the Muslim Brotherhood's Islamic Society of North America, coming back into the country from Canada and getting a secondary screening because the record in there red flagged and she gets secondarily searched. Well, she was working in the White House at the time. So, of course, she raised a stink and this went right to the top. And this is the kind of thing that was going on. This was a regular thing. So he got internal investigations at least 7 times that I'm aware of.
I think it was 9 all told, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think by the end, you're right. It may be 9. I mean, it's unreal, but that's the nature of doing this work. And then, of course, there was the accusation when he put out some of his information that he had used classified information. They went after him for that. And, of course, almost a year later of battling this, it turns out what he used wasn't classified because he knew the subject matter so well he could connect data points that he already knew in the unclassified realm. So that's the kind of stuff. I would say this, that Tablighi Jamaat, Jamaat-e Islami, the Muslim Brotherhood, the Deobandis, all these groups that exist out there are part of the same global Islamic movement. They're only delineated by where they were initiated, and the roles they play in the global movement.
And sometimes sect, differences, but they share the same overall purpose, John Gondolo. And you have documented that brilliantly in raising a jihadi generation, as well as in the training that you do. And I cannot commend it highly enough. The work of understanding the threat and find out more about it, participate in it, learn from John Gondolo and his team by going to understandingthethreat.com. John, we're out of time. There's so much more to talk about Phil Haney and of course, the fight that we continue to have to struggle with in his absence. I appreciate your leadership in that fight, as well as your visits with us from time to time. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Thank you for joining us in both memorializing and mourning the passing of our dear friend, Philip Haney. We'll hear from himself by the miracle of the recorded word right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a pleasure to say we are joined by Philip Haney, one of my personal heroes, a man who I've known and admired since he served in the United States government as a plank holder, as they say, one of the founding members of the Department of Homeland Security, beginning shortly after 9/11 when that organization was stood up. He's got, as a background, interestingly enough, a degree in the business of entomology, bugs, in other words, which has turned out to be an extraordinary training and skill sets for the business that he has devoted much of his professional life to, namely identifying, tracking, and helping defeat jihadists in our midst. Phil Haney is the co-author with Art Moore of See Something, Say Nothing, an extraordinary account of some of his travails in the United States government trying to simply do his job when it seemed to run afoul of the political leadership who wanted nothing of it. Phil Haney, it's good to have you back. Thank you so much for taking some time. Glad to catch up with you.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Well, Phil, I know you have been devoting a lot of time since you left government, in addition to exposing people to the content of your books and your personal experiences recounted there, to other challenges that we're facing from what I think is best described as Sharia supremacism. I know you've been traveling the country for this purpose. Tell us a little bit about what you're saying to the American people, what they need to be aware of, and to a substantial degree are not at this moment.
Thank you. I characterize it as being in the core of a nuclear reactor where a lot of very intense reactions go on. And what did I take away from the years of being in that furnace of experience of being investigated by the same individuals that we're seeing on the news almost every night now with the DOJ and the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security? What did I take away from all of that? And that's what I've been offering people in the audiences as I've traveled around. And the takeaway is the concept of sovereignty. We hear a lot of discussion about what we're fighting against, but what I have been encouraging people to consider is what is it that we're fighting for? And what we're really fighting for fundamentally is our sovereignty, which is our right to choose the form of government that we will live under without it being imposed upon us, as the global Islamic movement would do under Sharia, and or as the Antifa progressive leftists would do under a form of government that they define as more inclusive, more diverse, and so on.
And more Marxist, I think it's fair to say. And Phil, you know, this is interesting because we were talking at the beginning of the show with Daniel Horowitz about some of the threats to our sovereignty that are now being advanced, of all places, through our own court system. But you've been watching closely, both in government and now out, some of the efforts that are being made beyond the court system by these Sharia supremacists to insinuate their totalitarian program, political, military, legal, in our country.
and the help that they're getting from these leftists, the so-called red-green axis, as we call it. You've been most recently, as I understand it, traveling the state of Michigan. Can you describe some of the insights that you've gleaned from both your conversations with people there as well as what you've seen firsthand?
Sure. Let's look at the issue of Sharia law. We've been hearing more and more about Sharia lately. I remember it wasn't that long ago, 3-5 years, maybe less, that apologists within the Muslim community would insist that they have no intention whatsoever of implementing Sharia law here in America because they follow the Constitution. However, there's a shift. What I've noticed when I was in Michigan is that major front and center leaders of the Islamic movement in America, the main front groups for the Muslim Brotherhood, are now not denying that they intend to implement Sharia law. Now they're encouraging members of the Muslim community to explain Sharia without apologizing for it. This, my friend, is a violation of a major principle, an article in the Constitution, that is the Supremacy Clause, that says very plainly that the U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the land. And adding to your point about the judges, remarkably, it also says that the judges of each state shall be bound thereby. Now we're starting to see a real point of contact, a real impact point between a article of the Constitution, Article 6, and this effort to weave Sharia law or saturate, I'll use the word Sharia law, into our social political structure of our country.
You know, one of the things that I particularly wanted you to expand upon, Phil, we haven't talked about this in a while, but when you were in government, and one of the reasons you fell afoul of some of the powers that were, at least in the Obama years, was your careful analysis and data collection and warnings against and efforts to counter a group called Tablighi Jamaat. This is an operation that has largely been given a pass by successive administrations, it seems, and yet its agenda is, as best I can tell, every bit as much about this kind of insinuation of an ultimate supremacy of the Sharia doctrine in countries like ours. Remind us about this group and what we should be concerned about in terms of its unchecked operations in our country at the moment.
The thing that Tablighi Jamaat, which originates in the Asian subcontinent, Indian subcontinent, and the Muslim Brotherhood, that they have complete overlap in is their goal is implementation of Sharia law. Tablighi speak Pashtun and Urdu, while the Muslim Brotherhood speak Arabic, so culturally and linguistically, they're different, but their goals are exactly the same. And Tablighi has a cachet, an ability to travel around the world and basically interact with virtually every other Sunni Salafi or fundamentalist Muslim group in the world. So they are like the couriers of information between one group to another, and that's how they operated here in the United States. I started noticing the trend in 2006. They were violating the visa waiver program by traveling with two passports. It eventually came up to the National Targeting Center and became a global level initiative, they call it. And we had 1,200 law enforcement actions based on the case in the first 9 months. That's the case that the U.S. government shut down in September of 2012, about 2.5 years, if my math is right, before the San Bernardino shootings, which was done by Syed Farouk, a follower of Tablighi Jamaat and the Deobandi branch of Islam, which outside of America is known as the Army of Darkness. And there were just arrests made at the largest mosque in the Western world in U.K., for Tablighi Jamaat members plotting to do terrorist attacks right there near London. And so my concerns were borne out.
And not only were you commended for the work you had done in this regard, as you say, the cases that had been made, but it was Hillary Clinton's lawyers, as I recall, who were responsible for shutting it down. This is an extraordinary story, Phil, and I just wanted to get that update in front of our audience, because what we're seeing in terms of this so-called civilization jihad, that's the term the Muslim Brotherhood has used, is now, it seems, as you say, moving into a new stage, a higher gear, including in the political space in this country. And I'm very troubled that we're confusing Muslims who are like every other American citizen entitled to run for political office and swear an oath of allegiance to our Constitution and assume the responsibility, the freely assumed responsibility to defend and protect our Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. All of those, on the one hand, are no problem as far as I'm concerned. But it does seem increasingly as though there are entering into the various lists, as they say, the candidates for office, those who actually, whether they swear such an oath or not, have intent to pursue the subversion of our Constitution. Can you shed light on that as a problem? Is it real as you see it? And how so?
Yes, it's real. I use the term saturation, like a sponge floating on the water. It's an easy word picture to imagine the water soaking up into the sponge. So what is inevitably going to happen if that sponge floats around long enough in the water? It's going to become super saturated. So the question is, how do you waterproof the sponge being our country? Well, the answer is the Constitution. And is the global Islamic movement alive and well here in the United States? And how could I prove it if I make that assertion? One organization is proof that I need, and that is called the Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America, also known as AMJA, which in Arabic is Majama Fuqaha al-Sharia, you heard that word, the Amrikia in America. They are actively promoting the implementation, the saturation of Sharia law here in America. They are what I call the sun of the solar system of all of the Muslim Brotherhood and other related Muslim organizations. They all rotate around the sun and are held in place by directives and the fatwas that are issued by the Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America. That's the center of gravity. Open about it.
This is such an important topic. I am grateful to you for your service to our country, Phil, both that in government and that you're providing now, and I look forward to visiting with you further about it. Phil, we'll talk with you again very soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for our final installment of this conversation with Philip Haney, a career law enforcement professional in the retired status now, but along with the Department of Homeland Security, specifically with the Customs and Border Patrol Bureau. He is the author with Arthur Bohr of See Something, Say Nothing. A Homeland Security Officer Exposes the Government's Submission to Jihad, a sequel that is now in the works, entitled National Security Meltdown, which we await with great anticipation. Phil, thank you again for generously giving of your time today and for the insights that you've shared with us to this point. I did want to ask you, as you look at this sort of intensifying problem, not only abroad but at home, and the lingering effects of the policies that were adopted by the scoundrels of the Bush and Obama years, the question occurs, what do we do about this? And I thought it would be helpful, if you could, to share some insights about both what you saw and what you took away from your experiences during last year in two important states in our country, Michigan and Minnesota. and specifically with a view to telling us, you know, what your current thinking is about the way ahead for us.
Well, let me start off by saying that I am fully confident that it is possible to fix it. If I didn't believe that, I don't think I'd have the motivation to keep speaking about this subject in public, because why would I? I mean, what kind of a message would it be if all I said is hopeless? It isn't hopeless. I'm a field officer. I'm not a D.C. headquarters kind of person. I'm a field officer. And there are several holes in our national security system that are just as important to fix as the actual physical border that we hear so much about. And I would start by developing a, reinstituting a training course at the port level. I mean, when I say port, I mean the big airports for starters, like LAX and Chicago and Miami and New York, and teach the counterterrorism response team people the five-step approach, how to identify, how to interview, how to write up an interview, how to share it with fellow law enforcement, and how to do long-term follow-up. I think if I graded my agency right now, they'd fail on every point. And those areas need to be addressed. Those are like valves. Think of us as a submarine. We've gone down so deep, we're starting, you know, like in the movies, there's water shooting out all over the submarine. Well, how are you going to fix that? Well, you got to start opening and closing valves, and maybe come up and look from a higher depth. But it can be done. And then restore the information that was deleted, because right now we have this gigantic black hole of intelligence that was created like a bomb exploding back in 09, 10, 11, and 12. Can it be restored? Yes, it can be. And then start putting in the newer information that will start helping us aim in the right direction and intervene from people coming in. Now, that's from a field officer's perspective. That's not the full answer. But if we were able to do that, it would help quite a bit, just that alone. And then get focused on the border as well. And third, enforce immigration law, which we don't do very well at all. Look at the opposition President Trump had when he tried to do the executive order to start being more careful about the people from the original seven and then six countries. And the reason why he chose those is because they have no functioning government. So we can't really be confident that the travel documents individuals from there have are really genuine. We don't actually know who they are. So there are several areas, if I had the chance, I could participate to help with. And designation of the Muslim Brotherhood would be great, because groups like CARE and ISNA and Islamic Society of North America and NAIT and the Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America would no longer have access. They literally walk up and down the halls of Congress and the Rayburn and the Cannon Building and the Longworth Building, going right into members of the House and or the Senate and having a corrosive influence on our national security. They wouldn't be able to do that anymore. And groups like CARE would not be able to intrude into the law enforcement arena, into training programs. They wouldn't be writing letters to national security advisors and so on. They would not be able to have any influence. Well, why don't we try that? Because it wouldn't take, it doesn't require firing a single shot or dropping a single bomb anywhere. And yet it would send a shockwave all over the world.
It would. I did want to ask you, though, talk a little bit about your time up in Michigan and Minnesota. These are two states now that have very large populations of people who have come here, unlike many in the past, who I believe were from the Muslim world but came here to get away from Sharia. Some now, in significant numbers, maybe their second generation as well as newcomers, but have come here with Sharia as kind of their agenda. What is the Brotherhood's role in those communities? And as you traveled about, did you find people, Muslim individuals, who were anxious about what they were being you know, subjected to by the brothers and their agenda.
Yes, one of the most amazing things I found out, spending 5 months up in Michigan, Minnesota, during the primary and then the midterm election, is that about 20% of the Muslim population in the whole country, including those two states, votes Republican. And those are the ones who came here to get away from the influence of Sharia. And I would send a note to the RNC, a memo, if you want to really gain some allies, start listening to those registered Republicans within the Muslim community. They will tell you that the community is fractured. There is a lot of stress and pressure. It's not a monolith. It's fractured between ethnicities, different points of origin, different languages, different customs. But the bull in the china shop is the Muslim Brotherhood. They barge their way into the community. They take over the mosque and they start imposing a Salafi, Sharia-based form of Islam. And if you don't like it, they just push you out, literally.
Yeah. And that ostracism can have profound societal as well as perhaps, you know, commercial as well as physical implications for those that are being, as you say, pushed out. And Phil Haney, you know, just to put a fine point on this, that is in part, I assume, because we have imputed to the Muslim Brotherhood, we meaning successive U.S. governments, if not as an organization, then certainly their various fronts like the Council on American-Islamic Relations and the Islamic Society of North America and the like, a legitimacy that has enabled them to claim to be leaders of the Muslim community. No?
Yes, they use it as a hammer. They walk in with this attitude of arrogance. Well, we're endorsed by the U.S. government. You better do what we tell you. Otherwise, you know, there might be some bad consequences. And there's an attitude within the Muslim community that Arab-speaking Muslims, meaning from the Arab-speaking part of the Middle East, particularly the Muslim Brotherhood, are bullies. They don't like them because they have this concept that they are superior. They're the first ones that Muhammad spoke to. And so therefore, they're like, you know, the bearers of the flag of Islam, and you better do what we say. And the rest of the communities, ethnic and immigrant community, resent that greatly. But they're, what can they say? What can they do? They have no allies.
Well, that's where we come in. Phil Haney, you are one of the heroes for me and many others in both standing up against this internal threat as well as helping the rest of us understand its wellsprings and what can be done about it. God bless you, my friend. Talk to you soon. We'll talk to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.